My guest this week is John Harris, the journalist who made his name first as a music writer and now as a political commentator for The Guardian. John, you've chosen someone whose life doesn't seem to need much explaining. But if I point out that John Lennon, murdered 30 years ago this year, would have turned 70 in October, it's a reminder for those of us young enough to remember when the Beatles first burst on the scene that part of the ageing process is to watch our contemporaries becoming history. So, a great life, because part of recent history, a famous life, sure, but John Harris, so is Alvin Stardust, Paul Gascoigne, Arthur Scargill. Beyond that, what's your case for Lennon?
My case for Lennon is that he, in collaboration with the other Beatles, not only pushed rock music, popular music, into places which, if you'd have told people in 1962 that's where it was headed, at speed, I mean, that's the other thing, the accelerated pace of that musical progress. What he did there was mind-boggling, even more so at a distance now. Pop groups move at a snail's pace, even the most talented ones, relative to the Beatles. But I think in doing that as well, he contributed to and arguably led huge social changes and cultural changes, which we now take for granted. And I think that's very important. And that applies to class chiefly, I think. I think the expectations that people who go to comprehensive school have about where they may end up, rightly or wrongly, I think all of that has something to do with a great sort of social watershed and an opening up of very British hierarchies that occurred in the 60s. And I think John Lennon was central to doing that, and I think he himself embodied it as well.
You'll hardly have been around first time.
No, I was born in 1960. I'm a victim of what the Canadian author Douglas Copeland has called legislative nostalgia, which is being forced to have memories you don't actually possess.
What are your first memories of Lennon?
Of this, very straightforward. When I was 5 years old, in 1975, which was only 8 years after Sgt. Pepper had come out, which, if you think about that now, I mean, that's only like talking about 2002, which seems quite close. To shut me up, the babysitter sat me down in front of what must have been a radiogram, if you remember those, and put Sgt. Pepper on and handed me the sleeve, and it came with a set of cutouts. And she gave me a pair of scissors, which, in the context of eBay and so on now, it seemed mind-boggling. And I cut the cutouts out and sat there and listened to it. And I can recall this sort of warm glow. I still get that from Sgt. Pepper. It has a quality of sort of musical sunshine, and being absolutely mesmerised by it, and then staring intently for at least 15 or 20 minutes, which when you're five is an eternity, or all the faces on the sleeve. And in retrospect, that's when I understood that pop music was this huge, fascinating and really enticing universe, you know, and I'm still stranded there to some extent.
So in a way, he was the figure who invited you in.
Yeah, that's true. And then talking to people about him, my mother in particular, who saw the Beatles play in Liverpool when she was a student there, I was very taken with a sort of mischief and irreverence and an implicit sort of anti-authority position on the part of Lennon in particular that was never churlish or mean-spirited. I mean, it's very easy to think of the tenor of pop culture as regards being anti-establishment and think of someone like Sid Vicious, who's just a sneering little creep. But the Beatles always had a winning quality about them. And I think when I got to sort of 12 or 13, I just thought that was magnificent. I mean, probably when I was sitting at the back of French classes in school, I think when I was making mischief, I thought I was doing it. I wasn't, of course. I was just a horrible little Herbert. But I was doing it in my own head on a sort of slightly elevated level. And I thought I was being like John Lennon at a Beatles press conference of being fantastically mischievous and witty. He's a sort of archetype that as you enter your teens, you want to aspire to be like.
Where would you place John Lennon's limitations? What stopped him being an even greater life?
That's quite a misplaced question, because he achieved more, certainly in the period of his career, if you want to use that word, that lasted from 1962 to about 1969, the most creative people could dream about. To some extent, what I'm arguing about, and this consists in underlining strengths of his and things that he did, which I think are overlooked, is the sort of sanctified version of him, which took root partly thanks to the sort of myth-making of his widow, Yoko Ono. But also what happened in this country as of the mid-1990s. I mean, I cut my teeth during the so-called Britpop period as a writer. And thanks chiefly to the Gallagher brothers of Oasis, John Lennon was turned into this ridiculous caricature, falling somewhere between this person who was very sort of self-confident and had this inbuilt kind of anti-pretension weapon and hated all things pretentious and self-indulgent. It was the embodiment of authenticity, which is absurd. He's, you know, he became, I would argue, one of the most self-indulgent and pretentious musicians the world's ever seen. That's one aspect of it. And the other one is this sort of sainted, all he was saying was give peace a chance thing. And I don't think his political side ever added up to very much at all. I don't look for my political lead to John Lennon in any way. I like him because of his musical aspect. And music's at its best when it deals in the indecipherable and mystical and odd, not when it's talking in terms of programmatic politics. And I thought his programmatic political side was pretty abjectly awful, really.
Our expert witness was a big figure in 1960s counterculture. Barry Miles set up the International Times, Britain's first underground newspaper. He first met John in 1965, and he's the man in whose gallery and in whose presence John Lennon was first introduced to Yoko Ono. Barry, tell us about that scene.
Seems an awful long time ago now. Back in the 60s, I used to be the co-owner of a bookshop and art gallery called Indica. We always used to sell a lot of Yoko Ono's Fluxus books and posters and magazines. And when she came over to Britain in 1966, she came to our gallery, obviously, I mean, because she was one of the few contacts she had. The gallery was actually run by John Dunbar, who at that time was married to Marianne Faithfull, and he was the person who actually introduced them. It was only 2 years later they actually got together, so although a lot of people blame John Dunbar for introducing them, it can't be laid on him. And also, I think actually it was a very good move, in fact, when they did finally get together. I think it, in many ways, saved John's life.
Well, I wanted to ask you both about that, because this is period, 65, 66, when he's moving towards the next phase in his life. Now, I get the impression, listening to John, that John also thinks that the best part of his career in many ways was over at that
not
point.
Not quite, no. 66, 67, 68 to some extent, I think he's still in fine form. But I think there's a tendency, because people are very hung up on the idea of rock music as art, having sort of high-flown ideas, that if you over accentuate that period, you miss how great the early Beatles were and John Lennon's role in that. I mean, in terms of elemental excitement, those early records, I mean, if you listen to She Loves You or I Want to Hold Your Hand, I mean, A, it sounds like they move at 1,000 miles an hour. I mean, they're so exciting, those records. And, I mean, John Lennon's vocal delivery, if you listen to Twist and Shout, is a legendary example of that. You know, no one had ever sung rock and roll like that before. Within that as well, I think there are two things. I think, first of all, the early Beatles androgyny, the fact that they not only looked to some extent like people who were toying with gender, with these unheard-of mop-top haircuts and tight Pierre Cardin suits and all that. But John Lennon in particular, a lot of his songs from that period are all about crying and being vulnerable and pleading with your lover not to leave you. And they were covering songs by the girl groups, you know. On the first Beatles album, there's a song called Boys, in which Ringo Starr sings, "Don't you know I like boys?" They sing absolutely fearless about embracing this completely non-macho sort of stance. And then you get something like John Lennon singing Please Mr. Postman, which is a song by the Marvelettes, a black girl group from the States.
From around 1963, Please, Mr. Postman. You, Barry, and your gallery, and Yoko Ono, and perhaps with a little bit of help from LSD and all the rest, began to take John Lennon away from that sort of rawly energetic phase.
I think he took us away, more like. There was a huge change in the Beatles, obviously. Songs like Mr. Postman and Boys and everything, I think, comes actually more from naivety, just to go back a little bit on what you were saying, rather than any attempt at breaking through gender roles.
Oh, no, or anything. I'm not suggesting at the moment it was deliberate, but the point was, its effect was...
Oh, yes.
To dilute the extent of rock being all about thrusting your pelvis and curling your lips. Something
Absolutely.
Very interesting happens, perhaps accidentally, but it is incredible.
Most of these songs were done for nightclub performances in Germany and then later on in the Cavern. So they just had to have a very, very long repertoire, you know, any songs that they could get the words to.
But I take John's point, though, that other rock singers of that era, given a song which was obviously written for a woman to deliver, wouldn't themselves have delivered it because they would have thought it sounded wrong.
Well, this is true. This
the
is
Beatles
true.
Didn't care about that.
Actually, you're right, they didn't care.
And it's incredible. Because men and adolescent boys do sit there waiting for the... Or did, you know, before the age of email, sit there and wait for the postman to arrive, feeling sick with worry that it's so
true.
Far away. And you wouldn't get that from Billy Fury, or the rockers that had preceded the Beatles. And then the other point is their own compositions. If you think about a song like It Won't Be Long, which begins the Beatles' second album, as Lennon wrote the lyric for that, it's fairly certain. And it says in it, every day the tears run down from my eyes, every night I've done nothing but cry. This is pretty vulnerable stuff.
Well, I think Lennon all along was writing very, very personal songs. And unlike McCartney, he didn't universalise them. He stuck to the first person, you know. And no one really noticed. I mean, this is something... When I was working on the book I did with Paul McCartney, he said, all along, John was putting forward these really extreme emotional statements, and nobody noticed. You know, we just, we go in and, you know, what key's this in? And they just sang the damn thing, and, you know. And he was pouring his heart out to them. I must go back, though, to Boys. That I remember talking to Paul about that. He said it was only years later they realised, oh, that's why all the gay people, like, you know, used to buy that. You know, it never even occurred to them, you know.
I remember, you've got to hide your love away, which I thought was a sort of gay theory.
Oh, there is a theory that was written about Brian Epstein.
Do you think so?
That might be the case. Yeah.
Anyway, moving on now to the what we might call the Barry Miles phase of his life, the psychedelic phase and all the rest. I mean, let's just listen to a little bit of that sort of music. What should we have?
I would suggest that in terms of actually pointing out the continuity, which again is really overlooked, between the sort of vulnerable, keening, yearning Lennon, the confessional Lennon, and the psychedelic period, the best thing to play is I Am the Warrior.
This is 4 years after Please, Mr. Postman, and it's just so completely different. I was a bit of a straight-laced youth, and I thought that I Am the Walrus stuff and Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds stuff was complete crap. I thought, what's gone wrong? What's gone wrong with the Beatles sound? What's happened to this man? Am I missing something? What's our estimate?
Well,
now?
I think they always wanted to bring their fans along with them.
Yeah.
But the speed that they were developing intellectually and musically was so great that I think people did get a bit mystified, particularly later on when Lennon was doing pure abstract sound, you know, on the White Album, for instance, with Number 9 and things like that. These were more or less sonic exercises. I mean, this comes from listening to a lot of music concret, as they called it then. Particularly Paul McCartney was spending a lot of time going to experimental concerts with Cornelius Cardew and all these kind of people in London. And he would go back and tell Lennon all about it. Lennon tended to be sort of stuck out in the country.
In Weybridge. In fairness, he wasn't playing golf, though. He was ingesting large amounts of hallucinogenic drugs.
He was taking a lot of acid, yeah.
It's not quite the vision of washing your car in the drive on a Sunday morning.
The impact of all those drugs is quite clear on a track like that. He really took LSD in particular on board being Lennon, he did a good job on it. You know.
I didn't have any strong disapproval of his taking LSD. I was quite curious about it myself. But the point was, his listeners weren't taking LSD, a lot of us weren't, and I just felt the music didn't mean anything to me any longer. Was I missing something?
I mean, even 7 or 8 year old, when I heard that stuff, I just thought it was so brimming with musical fascination. Even going into the 80s. I remember being mocked at school because I just thought that Adam and the Ants or whatever was the in thing at the time, just couldn't really compete in terms of how much there was going on in these records. Then you begin to think, probably with a sort of critic sensibility, about what's happening there. I mean, I Am the Walrus was quite tongue-in-cheek. He received word that, I think it is old school, Quarry Bank, they were now analysing some of his lyrics as poetry. So he decided to sort of send that up. But in doing so, there is an argument, which is in Revolution in the Head, which is the brilliant sort of dissection of the Beatles songs by the late Ian MacDonald, where he says that I Am the Walrus, I mean, I'll quote this, he says, I Am the Walrus became its author's ultimate anti-institutional rant, a damn you England tirade that blasts education, art, culture, law, order, class, religion, and even sense itself. And it kind of does do that. It takes pops at experts and people kicking Edgar Allan Poe as an example of, you know, someone who the establishment couldn't make sense of. And then it keeps coming back to this refrain of I'm crying. And it's fascinating. So it's not just musically adventurous, I don't think. I think lyrically there's something really interesting going on.
You've called him, or the Beatles, John, a four-man battering ram through the class system. And yet by this stage, the stage we're talking about now, yeah. I Am the Walrus, he's effectively departed the class from which he came.
Well, let's not overstate that either. I mean, John Lennon, as part of his self-mythologising, wrote a song called Working Class Hero. I mean, again, that informs the more sort of idiotic stereotypes of him. He was brought up with sort of respectable lower middle class values by his Aunt Mimi. I mean, his favourite books as a child were the Just Williams stories. So this isn't someone who was going out stealing cars at an early age and was degenerate. I mean, that isn't the case. The fact that they were from Liverpool is important here, because class has a sort of regional dimension. And for four young men from Liverpool to come down to London and then position themselves on the cutting edge and lead the whole of popular culture by this point, not only into what we now know as psychedelia, but, I mean, the entire pop cultural fascination with Eastern mysticism, which still prevails. The Beatles were the first there. Now, for someone from suburban Liverpool to lead the charge in that direction, I would argue still says something about the transcendence of class and denying the limitations of it. It's definitely about the transcendence and the knocking down of hierarchy.
And they just didn't seem to care.
No.
But actually, Lennon was very nervous and self-conscious. In fact, I don't think I've ever met a more self-conscious person. When he was in a room with people he didn't know.
Really?
And most of the sort of rapier wit was actually just rudeness, you know, because he was so defensive. After all, it was John Lennon who came up with the line, you know, avant-garde is French for bullshit, you know, and he really did believe that because he was so scared that someone was going to pull one over on him and make him look a fool.
It's not like someone like Mick Jagger, who I think because Mick Jagger was from London and had been to the LSE and so on. Mick Jagger, you probably correct me on this, you may do, always had this air of loose self-confidence about him.
Yeah, he did,
right?
Yeah.
And John Lennon wasn't like that. And the weakness and the vulnerability and the nervousness allowed me to identify with him even more.
I think that is part of his popularity, is that people could identify with that side of him. And just in his general demeanour and the way he conducted himself in public, I mean, he had this witty sort of surface, and he was very sharp, very fast, but he was still very, very vulnerable.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest, John Harris, the Guardian columnist and long-standing music writer, has chosen the life of John Lennon. Our expert witness is Barry Miles. Before we return to the fray on the question of Lennon's greatness, can we just have a quick look at where he came from? You were saying, John Harris, that he was brought up by his aunt Mimi, and that it wasn't really a working class, but a lower middle class background. Was it a secure background?
Before the age of 4 or 5, he was brought up largely by his mother, Julia. His father was a merchant seaman who kept disappearing. And then there's this horrible episode when he's that age, when his father says to him, "Who do you want to go with, your mother or me?" And if you read accounts of that, I mean, it's absolutely heartbreaking. I think probably traumatizing for the rest of his life, and accounted to some extent for the nervousness and insecurity we're talking about. And then Mimi lived in Woolton, which at that stage was where the Liverpool sprawl sort of bled out and blurred out into the countryside. And I think John Lennon was raised in a very loving environment. He's talked himself about the fact that he had a happy childhood. But you have to, A, bear in mind the traumatic nature of his separation from his mother and his father, and then the fact that he developed a relationship with his mother. And there are accounts which suggest it was quite Oedipal, actually. I mean, that he felt a sexual attraction to his mother. And then she was run over when he was 18. And he said himself he lost her twice. He lost her when he was 4 or 5, and he lost her again when he was 18. And I think that definitely marks a turning point in his life where he becomes, I think, much more driven. I think that accounts for the Beatles' success to some extent, but I think he becomes even more insecure.
Do you think, Barry, that Yoko was in any sense a mother substitute
for
him?
He used to call her mother. I mean, those songs, you know, Mother is a John Lennon song. It's and it's not just about Julia, his mother. I remember McCartney telling me once how he and John used to go and visit John's mother, and she would like play the banjo and they would sing and everything, and then they would go home and John would go home to Aunt Mimi, and he said there was just something wrong here. We'd had a nice evening, but why isn't he staying with his mum? Why is he living with his auntie? You know, so there was always this kind of problem there, you know, an insecurity that he wasn't properly loved.
What, in your view, John Harris, did Yoko Ono do to John Lennon's artistic life?
He definitely sent it into decline, is my opinion. Barry mentioned earlier the fact that he took LSD, acid, very methodically, in keeping with the Timothy Leary view of it, which is that you destroyed your ego being what ruins society and takes it in an acquisitive and selfish direction. And there are accounts of him so losing any sense of himself that Derek Taylor, the Beatles press officer, on a famous occasion in 67, I think, has to sit him down and play him Beatles records and say, you did that. That's how good you are. Because he'd forgotten, right? So he's in this absolute state of losing any sense of himself. He's trapped in a marriage which clearly isn't working. And then along comes this very ambitious Japanese woman who's 8 years older than him and gives him a real sense of self. And he then gets co-opted into the more sort of moronic, silly aspects of the avant-garde. So you then get things like planting two acorns for peace and having a week in bed in Canada and Amsterdam to somehow achieve peace. But they don't say no more war in Vietnam. There's nothing specific about it. And it just doesn't make sense. It's self-indulgent and it's silly. And then you get one tremendous burst of creativity where, sort of under her tutelage, I think, he's trying to sort of exercise the worst bits of his own psyche. The John Lennon Plastic Ono band album that came out in 1970, which is, I mean, that's the birth decisively of what they call angstrock, singing about your own pain. And it's so, I feel very ambivalent about it. It's compelling, but it also ceases to have any sort of universal resonance. I can't identify with anyone singing about how awful it was being famous, because I've never been famous, you know. So I think a track we're about to hear, the middle bit of God, which is on that, is him singing at the end of the 60s, really, about everything he doesn't believe in anymore. And it's compelling, but at the same time, I think it just ceases to be universal. I think he stops speaking to a wide audience, really.
Just believe in me. Yoko and me.
I think the point is that Yoko Ono, as I say, by sort of indulging him and not being a check, it's very easy to forget that about the Lennon-McCartney relationship, that when it worked at its best, they checked each other. Like all great collaborators do. They encouraged each other's best aspects and then tampered their worst aspects. And that doesn't happen with Yoko. And the pair of them, I think, fly off into self-indulgence and silliness
often. John and Paul really, really valued their songwriting partnership, quite apart from their friendship and quite apart from the Beatles. To them, the songwriting partnership was, like, absolutely sacrosanct. Yoko had nothing to do with that.
But the other thing that seems to happen is she fleetingly also encourages this sort of flirtation with Radical Chic, which I just thought was objectionable, really. I mean, it was there in the bed-in for peace, and then you get the worst record of his career, sometime in New York City, which came out in 1972, when he was hanging around with Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, these sort of self-styled cultural urban guerrillas. And it's dreadful, and he has a song about the IRA and a song about the Attica prison riot, you know. I think Yoko definitely doesn't put any sort of brake on that, and I think she encourages it. But I think we should also, in fairness to John Lennon, never forget that the Beatles, like all great rock groups, were bigger than the sum of their parts. And none of them have had wholly brilliant solo careers, to say the least. And their experience of the 70s, respectively, was not all that. I mean,
well, the Beatles were very, very democratic. They didn't release anything unless all four of them agreed to do it. And that's what, of course, changed once the band broke up.
Yeah. It's easy to think with that generation that probably three quarters of them all went into career decline of one kind or another, eventually. But, and that happened with all of the Beatles, I would argue. But some of them have rallied and still make pretty amazing records. That applies to Bob Dylan, and it applies to Neil Young to some extent. And they're still restless, and every time they bring out a record, you're still interested.
Do you think he might have?
Yeah, that's the point. And Paul McCartney of late has released songs from time to time that have really caught my attention, and I've sensed the idea that he's breaking out of his own self-imposed limitations. So I think it's too easy to think that because the last record he made before he was assassinated, Double Fantasy, was this pretty cloying, bland picture of domestic bliss. It's really not all that, but we just simply don't know. And I'd much rather John Lennon was here.
Will the years, the decades, maybe even the centuries, do you think, Barry, be kind to his legacy and his memory? Which way do you think it's headed?
I'm not sure whether it'll be kind to him as an individual. Certainly the Beatles, I think, you can't get around. I mean, they're a roadblock in popular music history. You just have to deal with them. You know, you can't ignore them. I think Lennon's own compositions, yes, people will be writing PhDs in 50 years. You can be sure of that.
I agree with that as well, because if you take the Beatles' career, really, the 7 years in which they were making music as a group, it's interesting. It's often claimed we live in an accelerated culture where everything moves really quickly. We don't, actually. It moves very, very slowly now. Groups only release albums, big groups, only release albums every 3 or 4 years. The Beatles moved so fast. And if you look back, it's mind-boggling to the point that you begin to think something supernatural was going on. How do you go from Please, Mr. Postman to I Am the Walrus in 4 years? I mean, it really does sort of test your belief. So there's that. That's what makes it absolutely incredible.
It was, though, the time when rock and roll was moving from being part of popular music, I mean, being part of vaudeville, really, and entertainment, you know, into an art form, just like sort of opera and photography, and it was maturing, films, for instance. And this was an incredibly important period. It's when Dylan and lots of bands were making the same kind of moves. It's just that the Beatles were the leaders.
As quickly or in as assured a way. I mean, the point is they didn't really put a foot wrong.
They didn't.
A last question, John, about Lennon the man rather than the musician or the legend. What do you think John Lennon really wanted out of life generally?
I think he's like all of us. I mean, there's a lovely story from when the Beatles went to India to hang around with the Maharishi, this sort of guru figure. And he had a helicopter with 2 seats in it, one for him and one for someone else. And John Lennon barged to the front of the queue to go up in the helicopter with the Maharishi. And Paul McCartney said, "Why were you so keen to sit in that seat?" And John Lennon said, "I thought you might slip me the answer." Meaning the meaning of life, you know. And that's the point about John Lennon. He's a very damaged, vulnerable, insecure, weird, often nasty person. But the reason for that is because he is as full of uncertainty and doubt about the ultimate meaning of everything as the rest of us. And that's the point. I think too often, this doesn't just apply to musicians, it applies to politicians and all sorts of people. We want them all to be absolutely rounded, perfect figures who can show us the way. And that isn't the point. I think the great thing about John Lennon is he reminds us how insecure and how imperfect we are. And that's why I love him.
My thanks to John Harris, who chose our great life, that of John Lennon, and to our expert witness, Barry Miles. Goodbye.
Great Lives was presented by Matthew Paris and produced in Bristol by Christine Hall.